Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, where we catch up on political news of the week and preview the week ahead. I'm Amy Jarovich, in for Anna Staver today. And joining me in the studio is Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Services. Welcome, Shane.
Good morning.
Also, Haley B. Miller, political reporter for USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Welcome.
Happy Monday.
And Julie Carr Smythe, reporter for government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Welcome back, Julie.
Happy to be here.
And we'll begin with the news of another attempt being made to assassinate former President Donald Trump. The former president was golfing in Florida when Secret Service agents saw the barrel of an AK-style rifle sticking out of some bushes. The agents engaged with the suspect. He fled by car. He was apprehended on a highway a short time later. No one was injured. So, Julie, let's start with you. You were at the first assassination attempt in July in Pennsylvania, and that at the time felt unprecedented. So now we've had two. What are your thoughts here?
Well, it is unprecedented. Everything about this year seems to be, and the minute you think, you know, you're turning to in one direction, this happens. It's very unsettling that this would, that someone could get this close to him again after that. Everything I'm hearing this morning is that because he is not a sitting president and because this is a virtually public golf course, that it is difficult and probably impossible to lock that down in the way that some other former presidents might be able to do. For example, you know, if a former president is living in a gated community or in a house with huge walls, like that's a pretty easy thing to hold down. But Mar-a-Lago and then Trump's golf courses are expansive.
Yeah, and Haley, Trump and Vance, they've been starting to give speeches from behind bulletproof glass at rallies. But as Julie just said, this happened at a golf course. It's much harder to protect someone there.
Yeah, and I think there's, excuse me, this is also renewing the debate of how much Secret Service protection he should have since he is not currently in office. My understanding is that the resources are a little bit more limited for him. And, you know, there's a debate about that, especially in the midst of a really heated campaign, that perhaps he should have a little bit more muscle.
Yeah, and I heard an interview with a former Secret Service agent who used to be in charge of the program. He was on the BBC. I heard it while I was driving in this morning, and he said that he wishes, you could wish that, you know, maybe Donald Trump would take up a different sport that was easier to lock down than golf. But he said it's not just golf, it's all the rallies and the handshakes and the lines that they go through where they want to shake hands and kiss babies. He said it's just, it's American politics, and Secret Service can't lock it all down. What are you thinking about this, Shane?
There was some reports out there that Secret Service was trying to urge him to take more of his rallies indoors with the bulletproof glass. That might have been their attempt to maybe try to do some more security. But yeah, a golf course is a totally different animal, but you wouldn't expect someone to be able to walk onto a golf course and hide in a bush and possibly take a shot at the former president.
I do think that we don't as yet, or maybe ever will know the motive of the original shooter in Butler, Pennsylvania. But in this case, this person seems to be quite activated by the war in Ukraine, which is interesting. It's an issue that's been kind of in the back seat of this race. Right. You know, now we have, which I know we're going to talk about later, we have immigration coming front and center because of the things in Springfield, and we have had the debate, but really Ukraine is hardly being mentioned anymore. We have the Gaza war and things like that, so it will be interesting to see how that all plays out.
Yeah, and since he was apprehended alive, I mean, we can ask him these questions, see if he'll talk, explain himself, maybe.
Yeah, we have a bit of a social media trail, I think, which is how we know some of his feelings about Ukraine. It is wild to me that we still really don't know a lot about the assassination attempt in Pennsylvania. I mean, it's been a couple months.
He was just a young man who apparently kept quiet to himself, wasn't really that active on social media, was quiet, didn't have a lot of friends. I mean, there wasn't much you could go on.
Right. It's hard to imagine anyone nowadays not having a deep trail on the internet, but I guess some people do. Well, Julie mentioned Springfield, so we can pivot to Springfield. Former President Trump also made headlines for his false allegations that Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio, are killing and eating people's pets. Springfield city officials have repeatedly said that there is no credible reports of pets being harmed, injured, or abused by members of the Haitian community. And here's Governor DeWine talking to ABC News's Martha Raddatz on Sunday.
Let me tell you what we do know, though. What we know is that the Haitians who are in Springfield are legal. They came to Springfield to work. Ohio is on the move, and Springfield has really made a great resurgence with a lot of companies coming in. These Haitians came in to work for these companies. What the companies tell us is that they are very good workers. They're very happy to have them there. And frankly, that's helped the economy. Now, are there problems connected? Well, sure. There's when you go from a population of 58,000 and add 15,000 people onto that, you're going to have some challenges and some problems. And we're addressing those. We're working on those every single day.
And Haley, you know, the Haitian immigrants are here legally. They've been in the Springfield area. There's been more of them over the past 5 years. Do we know why Springfield specifically? I mean, Governor DeWine alluded to it in that cut.
Yeah, my understanding is that employers in the Springfield area were actively recruiting immigrants to fill jobs that locals didn't want for whatever reason. So I think that's been a big part of it. And then the other thing that Governor DeWine has talked about is that with immigration, there becomes sort of a word of mouth system. You know, some folks immigrate to a certain community. They find out they can get jobs there. Mm-hmm. They tell friends, family back in their home countries about the opportunities there. So I think, you know, that it's sort of the cumulative effect that we've seen over the past few years.
Even before this, all of this exploded with Trump talking about it in the debate, Julie, we know that DeWine sent $2.5 million to the city. And what were they going to, what was the plan with that money?
Well, they have been, apparently they've been helping Springfield for some time, particularly with housing issues. There is now crowding in the schools. There are huge language issues with this particular dialect in Haiti that they're now sending some money and have sent some money to allow people to be trained in translation as well as then to employ translators in, say, the schools or the social services agencies, things like that, because they're getting backlogged there. It takes something like three times longer to process a claim or an issue at a government office when you have to have a translator. So that's causing long lines. This is impacting hospitals. And so, you know, the crisis, if you want to call it that, or the issues that they're facing are real. It's just that none of them have to do with eating pets.
Right. And Shane, there's been a lot of backlash from all of this, and some of it doesn't even really make sense, but there's been a lot of these of bomb threats. So many, in fact, that Wittenberg University is going to be all online. Clark Tech is online all week instead of having their students come to class. So what do you make of this expanding to impact the rest of the city?
I mean, I think it's just the national mood right now where anytime you have a big issue like immigration come up, and the presidential candidates are putting a spotlight on it, you're going to have people, I don't know sure where they're coming from, where they're calling from, but, just coming in and making threats and calling from all over the country.
I just wanted to go back a little bit to the claim that was made, which was illegal immigrants are eating pets or cats and dogs, abducting and eating. And what we did in the media last week, which was a lot of hard work, but every piece of that has to be fact checked. So were they illegal? Were they immigrants? Were they cats? I mean, were they pets? And and the pieces of that had to be pulled apart. And that's where a lot of confusion came in, because as you said, these are legal immigrants. But also there was a case up in Canton, Ohio, that involved a person who had indeed been charged with animal cruelty, who had apparently killed and eaten a cat in front of people at her at her residence. Mm. She's in jail right now. However, she is not an immigrant. She was born in Ohio. She graduated from Canton McKinley High School. She's an Ohioan. The fact that immigrants are eating pets, there goes to that. Then you get into the piece of, were these pets? There's another whole string where the Trump-Vance campaign came out the day after this was fact-checked to say that basically the media is wrong and these cases are real and we have lots of accounts. And some of that relates to geese and ducks. Mm. There's never been, to my knowledge, any mention of a dog. So I don't know where that came mm-hmm. from at all. But there was the cat case in Canton, which was a U.S. citizen. And then that got conflated with what was happening in Springfield with a few random and ultimately unverifiable cases of complaints about geese being taken from city parks.
Yeah. And Haley, the Dispatch interviewed the man who took the photo. You've seen this photo around of a man walking around holding a goose. And the photo wasn't even taken in Springfield. What else did the Dispatch learn there?
Yeah, so that photo was taken in Columbus by a Columbus resident. And the original poster said that he's really frustrated to see his photo being circulated around, used for anti-immigrant sentiment, and, you know, wish he never shared it from the beginning. And, you know, going back to what Julie said about the geese and ducks, I did get records from Ohio Department of Natural Resources mm-hmm. that did indicate there were two complaints about people, Haitian residents, stealing waterfowl from like a local park or near a trail. It was like one in March and one in August, but mm-hmm. DNR was not able to substantiate either of those complaints. They couldn't find any evidence to back up what the callers reported. So,
yeah, and there was another 911 call where someone said, I've just seen four Haitians, each one is carrying a goose, leaving the park. Mm-hmm. And again, we went to the police. We looked at that report. That also was referred. That was maybe one of the ones that was referred to the Department of Natural Resources, because it's a different, when it's a wild animal, it's going to be a different whole mm-hmm. trajectory of the case. And so that was referred there and couldn't be substantiated. So we have done
our best. So the 911 call was real, but what the person was saying, they couldn't prove. Right?
Right. And they were alive at the time. The geese were alive at the time of the call, as far as I understand it. And so it's all very complex.
Yeah, fact checkers are having to work overtime on this, because every time they track something down, look into it, say, okay, this did or didn't happen, and usually it didn't happen, somebody else on social media puts out something that may not even be related, everybody else picks it up, a million people are retweeting it or resharing it, and then fact checkers have to work all over again. Isn't there now one in Dayton, I think, that Vance was sharing involving an animal that was being killed?
Yeah, well, but Vance went on television this weekend and basically said, used the word create, that we have had to create this story to draw attention. So there's some suggestion that he knew, and he's said in another context that it's possible all of the reports that he's gotten will turn out to be false. Then this weekend he said it was a created narrative. So they're trying to draw attention to immigration, and as we were talking earlier, a true problem that an Ohio city is facing.
Yeah, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and just talk about Springfield a little bit more. We have that cut from J.D. Vance. We'll play it right after this. You're listening to the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday, on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to the Weekly Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm Amy Jurevich in for Anna Staver today. And with me in the studio is Haley B. Miller, political reporter for USA Today Network, Ohio Bureau. Thanks again for being here, Haley.
Good to be here.
And Julie Carr-Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Hi again, Julie.
Hi.
And also with us, Shane Stegmiller, a reporter for Hanna News Service. Thanks for being here, Shane.
Hello.
And we are going to, the aforementioned, if you were listening before the break, in a CNN interview with Dana Bush yesterday, J.D. Vance made no apologies for continuing to advance the narrative of Haitian immigrants, and he explained why memes as messaging may continue to stay in the Republican playbook.
If I have to, create stories so that the American media actually pays attention to the suffering of the American people, then that's what I'm going to do, Dana, because you guys are completely letting Kamala Harris coast.
So he's, yes. So as we mentioned right before the break, Julie, he's saying he can create stories for the for the narrative, which is creating stories the same thing as lying?
Well, certainly. Well, yes, it is, actually. Okay. It's in this case, it is playing fast and loose with the facts and also ginning up particular negative feelings toward an immigrant group, a group of people of color. And so I think that it is a way to get attention on an issue that they're frustrated was not getting enough attention. But, you know, they could also call Haley or Shane or me, and they could say, you know, we would really love, we have gathered a bunch of information about the struggle of this city in Springfield, and we'd love you to get a team, a multimedia team down there to talk about the immigration issue. Have they done that, or have they just sat back and complained that the media isn't doing enough? I mean, I understand, having done this job for many decades, that, you know, we are a flawed institution and, you know, journalists don't do everything right. But at the same time, it seems a little bit disingenuous to me.
And, you know, before the break, we were kind of saying, Haley, you know, like, poor Springfield. They are really getting put into the national spotlight. There was even just a report that the Dispatch put out saying that a festival that they love having is being canceled.
Yeah, I think it's put a lot of folks there in a really difficult position. You know, one of my colleagues has spent some time there. She might actually be back there again today. And, you know, a lot of Haitian residents don't feel safe. They've talked about, you know, names that they've been called, especially recently. You know, by the same token, I think locals who have been there are also frustrated. You know, they've complained about things like not being able to find enough groceries. So, you know, going back again to the very real challenges that come with a sudden population increase, which is what Governor DeWine and others have been trying to talk about. Officials in Springfield have been trying to focus on that. But as we said, it's kind of gotten drowned out by all of the national fervor over this. And now schools can barely operate because threats keep getting called in, and, you know, it's just
and government buildings have been closed, colleges.
Yeah. And one thing we mentioned earlier, that Governor DeWine is sending money to Springfield to help, because there's certain things like infrastructure, even having enough teachers in the schools, interpreters, you know, healthcare issues. Whenever you have thousands of more people come into your city, you have to have services for them. So and one thing DeWine said is that he would like to see more services and training for Haitian drivers. And I think it's important to mention that because a lot of this vitriol started after a fatal traffic accident last year, that's kind of what put some of the spotlight on Springfield. A boy named Aiden Clark died on his way to school after his bus was hit by a Haitian who was driving without a valid license. And his father, Nathan Clark, spoke out last week and asked former President Trump and J.D. Vance to stop using his son's death for political gain.
I wish that my son, Aiden Clark, was killed by a 60-year-old white man I bet you never thought anyone would ever say something so blunt. But if that guy killed my 11-year-old son, the incessant group of hate-spewing people would leave us alone. They make it seem as though our wonderful Aiden appreciates your hate. Using Aiden as a political tool is, to say the least, reprehensible for any political purpose. And speaking of morally bankrupt, politicians Bernie Moreno, Chip Roy, J.D. Vance, and Donald Trump, they have spoken my son's name and used his death for political gain. This needs to stop now. They can vomit all the hate they want about illegal immigrants, the border crisis, and even untrue claims about fluffy pets being ravaged and eaten by community members. However, they are not allowed, nor have they ever been allowed, to mention Aiden Clark from Springfield, Ohio.
I mean, it's hard to listen to, right? And he, you can listen to the whole thing. There was he made about a 3-minute speech, basically saying that he was asking for an apology from some of these politicians for using his son's name, saying they didn't have permission to use his son's name. And so it's become a big issue, you know, with immigration. You know, even it was a traffic accident. Right.
Right. Yes. And the man did hit a school bus, and it was one child, Aiden, was killed, and many others were injured. So it did draw attention there. I will say that the governor convened a bus safety task force after that, and they've put out some recommendations because, you know, there were no seatbelts. There often aren't seatbelts on school buses and things like that. And so he tried, you know, we need to make mention that the governor has a long history of connection with Haiti, because his family has operated supported a charity down there for decades. It's named for his daughter, Becky, who had died in a traffic accident. And it helps educate people in this very poor country. So he's quite familiar with and spoke about, you know, what the driving is like there, what the life is like there. And so I think that he's trying to dial the intensity of this back some.
And Shane, what do you make of hearing from Aiden Clark's father, just talking about basically wanting an apology from these politicians?
Well, you can only imagine what he's going through even before this hit the national conscience in the last week. I mean, there were already political ads running in Ohio that were highlighting that accident as, you know, an attack on Sherrod Brown or President Biden over immigration policy in America. So imagine having to sit there and turn on the TV, and every time there's a commercial, you're seeing the tragedy of the accident that killed your son being played in a political ad over and over again.
And Haley, he mentioned Bernie Moreno's name as a part of this. Has Bernie Moreno spoken much about Springfield? I don't know if I've seen much about him.
Yeah, he was actually there over the weekend with Secretary of State Frank LaRose talking about, you know, immigration has been a big part of his campaign and the Senate race in general. That was the case before this happened. And now I think, you know, this is, of course, just taking it to the next level. But Moreno has said that what's happening in Springfield is essentially the fault of, you know, Biden and Harris's immigration policies that, you know, he says Sherrod Brown has supported as well. So he is certainly using this as part of his campaign now.
Well, and I'm going to use that moment to pivot to the U.S. Senate race, since we mentioned Bernie Moreno, unless any of the three of you have anything else you want to add on Springfield. I don't want to cut you off.
I was just going to say, I don't know if it's been mentioned, but I've seen reports that Donald Trump might actually be planning to do a stop sometime in Springfield as well. So it's not going to go away in the national race anytime soon.
Okay, well, that will be interesting. We'll have to see if he actually ends up scheduling one, which university that's online only venue he picks, I guess, right? All right. Well, let's pivot to the U.S. Senate race. The U.S. Senate race in Ohio has tightened. For most of the summer, polls showed incumbent Democrat Sherrod Brown leading his Republican challenger, Bernie Moreno. Polls had Brown about 5 points ahead, and then it shrunk to 2 points. And we can debate the accuracy of polls here. But what about their messaging? What is gaining traction? What isn't? What are your thoughts here on the race as we head into out of summer and into actual fall? Julie?
You mean on this issue or on any?
And just, you know, we can't, the polls show them pretty close, but, you know, we can debate the accuracy of polls here. Do you think that it is probably close?
Right. Well, I just had a story over the weekend that talked about the, you know, how it has changed the calculus for Sherrod Brown that Kamala Harris is now the nominee as opposed to Joe mm-hmm. Biden. And, you know, she is really driving some energy, particularly among this coalition that was created in Ohio last year by the August special election with the 60% constitutional amendment and then the abortion rights issue one in November. So what I'm hearing is that, you know, that has really galvanized a bipartisan broad coalition that is working to try to work on redistricting and to elect Democrats, I think, to a large extent this year. But it doesn't always work for him to try to align himself with Kamala. It certainly didn't with Joe Biden, who mm-hmm. was one of the more unpopular presidents in recent memory. But it, you know, he needs to be very careful about that. And so he's appealing to the Trump possible swing voter who, with ads about unions and the dignity of work and lots of, you know, ads in factories and things like that. So that's going to be where Sherrod is going while also working to try to talk about abortion rights still. Other people are saying, well, that's an issue that's kind of in the past here. We already have our abortion rights vote in Ohio in the rearview mirror. And so that's not going to work for Sherrod. And maybe it's not. Maybe that's what these polls are showing because Moreno is working harder to get issues about immigration and particularly kitchen table issues, you know, groceries, inflation, rent, and that kind of thing into the sphere of political conversation.
And where he's really, Sherrod's been really trying to attack Moreno on too is, if you look at it, it's a labor issue. It's not paying your employees or people suing him over being shorted in their paychecks and such. Bernie seems to have like wrapped his hands around or arms around Trump. A lot of his commercials that he's running now feature Trump prominently, complaining about Brown, talking about how he votes with Biden all the time. So he's really, you know, hoping that Trump doing well in Ohio is also going to be enough to carry him over the finish line and win the seat in November.
Yeah, Donald Trump Jr. was in Lucas County, traditionally a more Democratic stronghold, with Moreno. And Donald Trump Jr. spoke about immigration and inflation and education. Do you think having Donald Trump Jr. helps Bernie Moreno, Haley?
I don't think it hurts. You know, I think it's an open question, even with Springfield in the news, of whether Trump comes to Ohio, because mm-hmm. this is not a battleground state anymore. But Trump did come here in the spring to help Moreno, so it could happen again. But, you know, to everyone's points here, I think Moreno really wants to nationalize this race as much as he can, and Brown wants to do the opposite. And mm-hmm. so that's what you've kind of seen play out on the airwaves, and I think that's what, you know, what it's going to be like through Election Day, especially because Moreno is not super well known. He ran for like a second in 2022, but he dropped out before that primary really heated up. So I think for him, it's more about painting Brown in a bad light versus kind of showing voters who he is.
Have any of you been following the money at all? I know that, you know, with the Republican National Committee nationally, what they do with their money kind of dictates what they think, you know, who's worth putting money behind. How's Bernie Moreno doing in that case?
Both of them are just, it's over the top. This is probably going to be the most expensive Senate race, I think, in U.S. history.
Oh, no.
Because it's really a must win for Democrats. They have a very narrow majority in the Senate, and they look at Sherrod as because of his longevity in the state and his electability, they look at him as someone who they can defend, even though he's now in a state that Trump won twice. So they are all over it, but it's being matched by the National Republicans as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's really Ohio and Montana that are going to tip the scales for control of the Senate, I think. And, you know, both parties obviously have a vested interest in that.
Montana's well known for its large TV markets, right? No, I'm sure money goes further in Montana than Ohio, I'm guessing.
Right. I was just going to say, so our story did about the pivot to Kamala versus Biden did get into Montana as well. And John Tester is defending there. And, someone said they believe that this is a mistake, that they're not tying their coat, themselves to Kamala Harris's coattails, because she's energizing a base of young people, people of color, female voters, and that this could really help. Not that Trump won't win Ohio, because he will, but that it could help these down ticket races to have some energy there in terms of the Supreme Court of the state of Ohio, which is going to make a lot of abortion related decisions upcoming, and also legislative races and things like that. But it's a delicate balance, because Sherrod needs to we see him tie himself to Trump even by saying, here's a bill that I sponsored that Donald Trump signed when he was president, and here's ways in which that I've agreed with Republicans on things, because he needs to look more centrist than his liberal record.
Well, before we take a break, let's just do a little reminder of key deadlines when it comes to voting, because, we're getting there as to when voting is going to be starting here. The last day to register to vote is Monday, October 7th, and registration at VoteOhio.gov. And then early in-person voting begins on Tuesday, October 8th. And the Franklin County location is on Morris Road. Haley, remind our listeners about the process if they want to get an absentee ballot. Could you go over that a little bit?
Yeah, so every registered voter in Ohio a couple weeks ago should have gotten an absentee ballot application in their mailbox. The Secretary of State's office sends that out automatically.
It'll have Frank LaRose's name real big in the return address area. Yeah.
Yes. But if you were not registered to vote at that time, obviously the first step is to register. And then you can either request an absentee ballot online, or you can fill out the paper form and mail it in, or I believe you can drop it off at the Board of Elections. And then you'll get, I believe, absentee ballots will start going out when early voting starts on October 8th. And then from there, you just fill it out and you have.
Absentee ballot applications are due by October 29th.
Yes.
The mailed ballots have to be postmarked by November 4th.
Right. And it's interesting, because I stopped at the post office on my way here, or at a drop box. And it was interesting. One of the drop boxes that's normally at this location had been removed, and the other one was super high security. I mean, you could barely see the hole that you put the letter in, and it seemed like it had.
Yeah, there's no more of those swinging doors.
No,
on them. You have to,
no. I mean, they have. And I'm wondering if that's sort of happening everywhere, where they're trying to assure people that mail-in voting is safe and that these are not tamperable boxes.
Yeah. And also, this, if for some reason you don't mail your absentee ballot back in time, you can always bring it to your Board of Elections office on election night before polls close. That's another option if you don't get it in the mail in time.
All right. Well, we will continue. We'll talk about a few other things that are going on in the news, including the latest on the redistricting issue one. That's in just a moment. We're going to take a quick break. This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, and I'm Amy Jurevich, sitting in for Anna Staver today. This is 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm Amy Jurevich, and I'm sitting in for Anna Staver today. Still with us, Shane Stegmiller, a reporter for Hannah News Service, Haley B. Miller, political reporter for USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Julie Carr Smythe, a government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. And I wanted to get into issue one a little bit. It seems like we always have an issue one, don't we? So this time, issue one is about redistricting. In November, we will be voting on issue one, which seeks to put the congressional and legislative map-making process in the hands of an independent commission. No politicians would be involved. Now, there has been some opposition for issue one from some Black former lawmakers. So, Haley, why are we hearing from former lawmakers opposing this issue?
I think their biggest problem is that Michigan established a similar independent commission. I don't know quite what the breakdown in Michigan was, so I don't know how directly it compares to the proposal in Ohio. But after Michigan reformed its redistricting process, a map was drawn that disenfranchised Black voters. There was a lawsuit over it, and they ultimately had to go redraw that. So I think these lawmakers are concerned that something similar could happen in Ohio. They say that, you know, the idea of ending gerrymandering sounds nice, but the devil's in the details. And it sounds like they see the potential for something like that happening here.
And I will add that coming up at 11, so stay with us here, coming up at 11, our next episode of Untangled, which is untangling redistricting this season, is going to take a look at Michigan, Arizona, and Iowa, and how they have reformed redistricting in their states and how it's working. So Shane, you've done a lot of writing about this. Tell us a little bit more about issue one.
Okay, so to go on to the point of the Black lawmakers too, there's this argument, it all comes down to the proportionality of being able to have a certain number of seats, maybe that lean Democratic or lean Republican. Mm-hmm. And there's an argument that in order to make some seats more Democratic or more seats more competitive, you're going to have to dip more into the Black communities, draw more of those precincts into, you know, suburban communities in order to get yourself a you know, more split or even a more Democratic. So that's where a lot of that argument comes from, too.
And if you want to learn more about proportionality, I can tell you to listen to last week's episode of Untangled, because Anna Staver did an in-depth look at the different ways that you can draw districts, you know, based on what proportionality means versus, you know, different ways to split up districts, how to draw them, what the definition of fair is, right? Which is a loosey-goosey word.
It's in the eye of the beholder. Right. Where we're at on issue one now, I would expect sometime this week the proponents of issue one, the Citizens Not Politicians group that brought the issue, is now before the Supreme Court. They're trying to overturn the ballot language that the ballot board written by Secretary of State Frank LaRose did. They're trying to get that overturned, arguing that it's very slanted. It uses the actual word gerrymander, even though that the actual language also says bans gerrymandering. So both sides are trying to get that overturned. You're coming up on a deadline that overseas ballots are going to have to go out here pretty soon. So the Supreme Court's going to have to act on that pretty soon. I think each side has submitted their merit briefs. They haven't had an in-person oral argument. I wouldn't expect at this point they would.
So if it's going to be rewritten, it has to be done this week?
It would
week.
Have to be done soon. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to see the Supreme Court. But they move at their own pace, too. Mm-hmm. So.
Right. They're probably aware, you know, that, I mean, they're obviously aware of the deadlines that we've just discussed. You know, we should say on the Black lawmakers opposing this that there was pushback from the pro-issue one side. I know that the president of the Ohio NAACP spoke about their support and the support of a lot of other civil rights organizations in the state. So I personally need to look a little bit more into the group that has been formed there, because, you know, we always like to know sort of who's funding them and where is that push coming from.
And the Ohio person on this is John Barnes Jr. He's a former Democrat lawmaker from Cleveland area.
Okay, and so just to remind our listeners, for this issue one, as opposed to past issue ones, what happens if you vote yes? What happens if you vote no?
If you vote yes, you agree to
create an independent commission.
The details for that, you know, the folks on that commission can't have been lobbyists recently, elected officials, other political connections, things like that. It's an even partisan split, I believe, and they would have the power to draw the maps. If you vote no, you are saying you do not want that to be created. You want to keep the current redistricting process in place.
Do we keep the current maps, or is that that's another issue?
That's a whole separate issue. Yeah, okay.
They would redraw.
Maps, yeah,
they right. would redraw
immediately.
I think it requires them to redraw immediately.
Right, but if it doesn't happen, then the current maps are in place for a period of time
to the end of the decade.
Are they?
Yeah, they when the
till the next census.
Well,
no.
Because so the General Assembly maps are in place till the end of the decade, because the redistricting commission, they got a bipartisan unanimous vote,
right?
And unless somebody challenges that in court, it should go to the end of the decade. Congressional maps will have to be redrawn next year, because that was struck down by the Supreme Court, and also because it was not a bipartisan vote when they adopted it through the redistricting commission.
Right. So it,
so it only goes for 4 years. Right. So they will have to redraw those next year.
So that was allowed by the courts for a one cycle, or, you know, a 4 year cycle.
All right. Well, we will pivot to the 11 o'clock hour and Untangled, so you can learn more about redistricting from experts on redistricting as well. And so another topic I wanted to touch on were the state report cards. The Ohio Department of Education and Workforce released the state report cards on Friday. Around Central Ohio, Columbus City Schools, the state's largest school district, showed no improvement. It remained at its 2-star ranking. And this year, several Central Ohio school districts did earn 5 stars: Bexley, Grandview Heights, Olentangy, Upper Arlington, New Albany, and Dublin. Shane, what do you make of the stars in these report cards? Do school districts really put a lot of weight into them?
Yeah, so this is an interesting thing, because this is the first time they've used the star. These will be the first report cards that reflect this new star system that was adopted in 2021. Before then, they were using an A through F, like, grade for districts. So in 2021, lawmakers decided to get away from that, and they created the star system. But unfortunately, because of COVID and other issues going on, they couldn't fully implement it until they got to this cycle for this past school year.
Okay. And you can go online and you can look up each school district's report card. You can also look up individual schools. They have star rankings for each school as well, right?
Yes. And so the most common ranking for districts across the state, was about 3.5 stars. That was given to 135 of the 607 districts. For the buildings, because buildings were also ranked on an individual basis, the most common rating
That's okay. Yeah, no, it's okay. There's one of your colleagues wrote about this. So yeah. Where can we read more about the report cards?
That you can go online at hannah.com. Our Friday report covered it. They also have it if you go to the Department of Education and Workforce's website. They also will have, you'll be able to look up your individual districts and school buildings.
Okay. And another issue that we didn't talk about before, the foreign money ban ruling. U.S. District Judge Michael Watson last week denied a request from the state for a stay while it appeals is ruling on foreign nationals contributing to ballot issue campaigns. What is the latest on this? Because it is confusing as to what you can do with foreign money in a campaign.
So decision that the state wants to appeal, it didn't toss out the entire thing that was signed back in May or June, whenever that was. And if listeners remember, this was tied to the fix for trying to get then President Joe Biden on the ballot for the November election. There was concerns over those deadlines because of when the DNC was. But the court ruled that Ohio's legislation went a little too far. It applied this ban on foreign money to green card holders, which some Republicans actually tried to warn their fellow Republicans in the legislature about before they voted on this. Green card holders are, you know, have rights in this country, and that's essentially what the court said. And so that piece was struck down. I believe the rest of it is still in place, but the state's trying to appeal that, and I guess we'll see what happens.
I thought that the issue was the state would like the whole thing to be upheld
right.
as a whole.
Yeah.
The argument is over the piece that was sort of one lawmaker warned, this is unconstitutional. If we put it in here, the law will be struck down. Mm-hmm. Indeed, it was unconstitutional. Indeed, the law was struck down. Or at least right now it's on hold because it seems, you know, normally the way that process works is that if you make what the judge thinks is a argument that's winnable once the case, then they will stay that law. And so that was where it was. And the fight now is over whether the green card piece can be spun out of it and just that be declared unconstitutional and them salvage the rest of the law. Do I have that right?
That sounds about right. They also, they even asked the judge if he could at least, you know, take out parts of it or kind of rewrite parts of it, let some of it stay in place. And he said that he wouldn't do that because he doesn't think he would necessarily land in the same place that the legislature might have done. And it's also interesting to add that I think Governor DeWine has said that they might just need to revisit the whole law, repass something without the green card part.
Right, because the courts, you know, we hear a lot about activist courts being a problem. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like the court is not in a position to rewrite a law.
Yeah.
They are just looking at the law, and even if only one provision of it is unconstitutional, can they really peel that apart?
It wasn't even the sponsor of the bill didn't want the green card part in there, right?
Right.
Right. And he, so, okay. Well, I guess we'll see where that goes. We have just a couple minutes left. First Energy has agreed to pay a $100 million fine to settle civil fraud charges filed by the Securities and Exchange Commission. This is related to House Bill 6, the power plant bailout. That's much higher than the $20 million fine with the state. Also, the utility's former top executive, Chuck Jones, will still face charges from the Securities and Exchange Commission. So I feel like House Bill 6 never goes away, right?
Right. Yeah, we're still sort of unpacking it. It's, you know, there's so much of it still left. Mm-hmm. I mean, Larry Householder's appeal is still active. Matt Borges, we recently learned, has been working behind the scenes to try to get to a lower security prison, saying that the mm-hmm. way that his sentencing documents were written inadvertently put him in a place that was higher security than need be. And he was the former Ohio Republican chair who got 5 years in prison. Mm-hmm. Householder is making some really interesting arguments in court regarding the fact that it was his free speech rights to participate in a system where you raised money into these dark money groups, and that basically the federal government doesn't think dark money groups should be legal, but they are indeed legal, and so that he should be allowed to be free.
And Cleveland.com had an interesting story recently about, you know, why there haven't been any federal charges levied yet against the bribers in this case, you know, the folks at First Energy. I would just it's just a plug for the story because I can't do it justice probably. But, yeah. you know, it is an interesting question, especially as we see Attorney General Dave Yost try to go after those folks in state court.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. And I want to say thank you for listening to the Reporter Roundtable. Thank you to Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service. Thanks for being here.
Always a great day to talk politics in the capital city.
Thank you to Julie Carr Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Thank you, Julie.
Thanks for having me.
And also thanks to Haley B. Miller, political reporter for USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Thanks, Haley.
Good to be here.
And thank you for joining me. And this has been the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm Amy Jurevich in for Anna Staver. And this is 89.7 NPR News.